The Mickey Miles Podcast is brought to you by MEI Travel and Mouse Fan Travel, who will handle your family vacation, reunion, honeymoon, corporate incentive trip, or getaway as if it were their own, bringing premium service and expert advice to help you get the most out of your vacation dollar. Visit them at MEI-travel.com or mousefantravel.com.
This is Bernie Edwards from Columbia, Maryland, and I love listening to the Mickey Miles and More Podcast, especially while running around the Imperial Palace in downtown Tokyo on a business trip. It keeps me going, and it's great to hear friendly voices. Thanks. Bye.
This is the Mickey Miles and More Podcast, your one stop for information on Disney races, Disney vacations, Disney theme parks, and more. Now, here are your hosts for the Mickey Miles and More Podcast, Michelle Scribner-McLean, Chris Eliopoulos, and Mike Scopa.
Welcome to episode 354 of the Mickey Miles and More Podcast. This is Mike Scopa along with Michelle Scribner-McLean. Hello, Michelle.
Hello, Michael. Some football event going on today as we're recording? I don't know.
Nope. When your team isn't playing, there is no
game.
All
I know is I'm going to get a lot of podcast work done tonight and a lot of
homemade pizza.
Work. Yeah, a lot of Mike's pizza.
Of course, this is being posted like 2.5 weeks beyond.
Oh,
the
okay.
Super Bowl,
well,
so.
Anyway. Yeah. Anyways. So I know the Patriots didn't win, but.
Well, anyways, we also have on the show Chris Eliopoulos. Hello, Chris.
Hi, Mike. How's everything?
It's been quite a day, but you know that's the way it is.
Chris, I'm supposed to say yes, it was good.
Yes, that's it was it. Good, Christopher. Right. How Chris are you? How many books have you written today? Drawn today?
I actually wrote a story today, so we're in good shape.
Wow!
Some other animal going to have it or what?
I can't talk about it yet. It's one of those kind of things where when I have to wait till it's announced before I can talk about it.
Chris and I have something really scary in common. Our boys are just 2 days apart in age, and Liam's driving around, but Chris has two kids driving around. Chris, can you tell people what you posted today? I thought it was hysterical.
My son was going to his girlfriend's Super Bowl party, so he was driving me in one direction, and passing us on the other side as we were going was my wife with my other son driving the car the other way. So we passed each other and waved and came home and looked at each other and said, "What's going on here?" Yeah, it's creepy.
Scary. Nope. All right, Chris, I am handing over for this show only, the powers of the shout out to you.
Oh, see, I wasn't going to. Well, I guess I could turn this into a shout out.
You went to Dom last time.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah. My new thing, I figured, I was talking to my wife, and she says my running playlist is very eclectic. So I thought what I would do at the beginning of each show is give you one of the songs that I listened to and maybe allow people to go out
and
seek
it out.
Not going to
sing it, is he?
No, I won't sing it, I promise. But it's so I thought I'd start at a baseline and give it a very even keel. I was thinking about it while I was running today. The first song is very simple. It's Unchained by Van Halen, our favorite
Len Testa.
Magician Len Testa loves it, so loves the band. So I was thinking of him while I was running today. So that's the first one that you'll be getting. And go to his site, touringplans.com, free plug.
Okay.
Sorry. There we go. We're done.
So today we're kind of excited because, as everybody who's listening hopefully knows, we're expanding the podcast to include more than just Run Disney. We're including more. And we decided that our very first More podcast would have to include someone very, 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 very important in our eyes as being in the Disney inner circle and also a very dear friend of ours. So we're excited to bring on someone who you may have heard before. His name is Sam Genoway. He's an urban planner by day, but at night he's a Disney historian. He's a lecturer. He's very fun to ride an attraction with in Disneyland. So we're very pleased to bring on Sam Genoway. Sam, welcome to the show.
Well, I'm honored and delighted to be here, and I want to hear more about this homemade pizza.
Talk to Len Testa.
Your own dough. Okay, go ahead.
Oh yeah, talk to him. So
it's quite the thing. Okay. Scopa pizza. You have one little 1-inch piece, and you don't have to eat for 4 days.
Yeah, it's
okay.
Very thick.
It's like it's about 150-year-old recipe, so almost as old as me. anyways, that was dedicated to Matt Hochberg. So Sam, we're excited to have you on. I know that Michelle and I, one of our most treasured visits to Disneyland was spending a day with you. And I will never forget, and I tell people as much as I can, that I can never, ever go to Disneyland again and ride Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, because you and I rode it, and that was the most exhilarating experience of my life. So I'll always thank you for making
and
that.
And I was
a special
in the car
ride.
Behind you guys.
Well, yes. You know what? It's the only ride at Disney. Everything else is an attraction or an adventure or a show, right? And one time I was standing in line, and a kid in front of me is going, "Oh, this is just a little kid ride." I went, "No, this is not a kid ride. This is your life story. You're going to go out. You're going to have a good time. You're going to get carried away, and then you're going to go straight to hell." So,
his parents said, "Wow. Who is that guy who's bothering you?"
Sounds like one of Chris's
torturing books. Children, man. The way to go through Disney.
No, the parent agreed. The parent was like going, "That's right, you'll see. And the kid was laughing when he came off the thing. But you know, that goes beyond just being a ride. It's very therapeutic, if you ask me.
Well, you know, Sam, I remember one time you and I and Michelle were talking about Disneyland, and you mentioned how we should always think of Disneyland as something that was created by movie people. And it was funny that you said that, because one time I was talking to Mr. American Adventure Lonnie in Walt Disney World in Epcot, and he even said to me, he said, "You got to remember one thing. These parks were built by movie people." And I remember you told me one time that the way to think about it is when you first go through the turnstiles and you start walking under the train station. Do you remember what you said?
Well, there's the whole thing is just, it's a metaphor for movie and movie entertainment, because that's what they knew. I mean, Walt Disney tried to hire Welton Beckett, his friend, who's a renowned architect who was working on something, worked on stuff like this, and couldn't figure it out. And he says, "Oh, well, you know, you got to do it yourself." So the way he hired his people, they were all 20th Century Fox backlot set designers for the most part, and they didn't know any better. And so when you go in through Disneyland, you're going from a lot lobby, or you're going to the first act is the parking lot, then through a lobby, and then you're going through a cross dissolve just like a piece of film, and you get the wide shot, the medium shot, the close up. It takes you to a whole another immersive environment, and then you're completely not only just immersed in another environment, but there's a reassurance that while you're walking through it, geez, everything is clean and it's working and it's right. And that's when you start getting all googly-eyed and wear really silly hats, which you would never do outside of the gates.
So, Sam, it's so fascinating, and I never enter a park without thinking about that as I go through the tunnel and enter Main Street. I think Mike, the last time I was with you, we were somebody who hadn't been to a Disney park, and you were explaining that same thing
too.
Yeah,
I was thinking of all the stories that Sam has told me.
So, the three of us, I mean, you could have your own 700-episode podcast of your own, because you have so many great stories. Just spending the day with you, I could tell that. But the three of us read your book, The Disneyland Story, and I was wondering if we could ask you some questions about that.
That'd be fun, yes. That was a fun book to write.
The first question I would have is, why did you write the book? I mean, I know you, so I know you have an interest in this, but can you kind of give us a little background of the book and how it came to be written?
Yeah, I was fortunate. I wrote one book before that called Walt Disney and the Promise of Progress City, which is still available. And that's kind of an urban planner's look at how Walt Disney created expectations for public space that influence absolutely everything that we do as an urban planner. So it was kind of a little more of an academic look of it. And the book was very successful. And then I was asked, I knew Len Testa, and through that, the folks over at The Unofficial Guide asked if I would write a couple of books. And I picked Disneyland as the topic because I grew up in Southern California. I knew that there were other histories about Disneyland, but there wasn't really one that I had seen that was, you know, fully documented and the big footnotes and all that kind of stuff. And the big inspiration was I was up at the Walt Disney Family Museum. I was giving a talk at the Walt Disney Family Museum about Mineral King, which was a ski resort that Walt Disney wanted to build in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. One of the really fortunate unfortunate things about that experience was that on the panel of the discussion was Ron Miller, which is Walt's son-in-law and was the husband of Diane Disney Miller. And so we were having lunch together, and I was talking with them about the park and her dad's sort of reaction to it. And I said, it seems to me like your dad would have thought of this kind of like your younger brother. She's going, yeah, really. You know, he would talk about this, about how it changing and evolved, because she was an adult at the time. And that's what made me really pause and think about that. You know, it is kind of true that Disneyland was the vision, a very singular vision of one guy. He was around for the first 11 years, and then he died, and then the thing kept going and not only survived, but it thrived. And there's very few examples in the United States of something that was such a singular project that would survive the passing of its founder so profoundly. And so the idea of writing about Disneyland as a biography, as about a thing, made the book a lot of fun, and it made it a lot easier to write, and I think a bit different than the other Disneyland history books that are out there.
I love that you can just say that, oh, I had lunch with Diane Disney.
It was like one of the thrills of my life was to be able to sit and chat with these two. And then as they're miking up Ron just before the talk, he turns to me going, oh, I saw your pre-show, Sam, and seems like you got it down. You don't really need me. I'm going, no, Ron, you've never talked at the museum before. You are the whole reason that Disney survived. I mean, he's the guy who created the Disney Channel, Disney on Video. Tokyo got the Tokyo Disney thing approved, got Touchstone Pictures happening, and very important player in the Disney corporate world that most people don't know about. So cool. I was very honored to be able to do that talk.
Chris?
Okay, I have like about 20 questions, Sam, because like...
Go for it. Like, what do you got?
Okay, this one's a little out there, but for the folks that don't know, Ward Kimball was an animator, one of the Nine Old Men with Disney, became a director, did the Disneyland show, did a lot of stuff on space. But I found it very interesting, his relationship with Walt, specifically when it came to his model railroading. How much did that relationship between the two of them spark the idea of a Disneyland?
Oh, I think that the whole railroad thing was absolutely fundamental. As a relationship between the two, they... when Walt Disney claimed that Ward Kimball was the only true genius at Disney, it wasn't designed to be a compliment. It was designed to be a way of Walt getting under Ward's skin and making the rest of the staff dislike Ward. very, very important. When I was trying to figure out, well, why would this guy as an animator go in and really throw his entire life into creating something that was so extraordinarily different? I went back and really looked at the history, and by 1947, 1948, after World War II, Walt Disney was not a very successful movie producer. Everybody else did really well. You know, Louis B. Mayer and the guys at all the other studios really did really well during World War II, but Disney just did not. It had no hits. It had no movies that were big hits other than Dumbo to an extent. They were really, really struggling as a studio, and then afterwards, you know, Mickey Mouse was boring. Tom and Jerry was a much bigger set of characters. There was a different animation studio, IPA, you know what I'm talking about, was the Mr. Magoo studio, was the studio of the moment winning the awards and stuff like that. And I think that Walt really hit a moment where he loved a lot of the guys that he was working with. He was disenchanted with animation because the strike that happened before World War II really hurt him. And he wanted to find something to keep the guys he really liked busy. And he didn't think it was going to be animation. And he was really searching hard to try to find that next thing. And when he hooked up with Ward Kimball and they went to this railroad fair in Chicago, and then soon after that went to Dearborn, Greenfield Village, the Henry Ford Museum in Michigan, that combination of events, I think, made him figure out that whatever he was going to do, it had something to do with a train, that a train was a universal connector to everything. And he started working really on two ideas simultaneously. One was a railroad-based experience that would travel the country. And he was also hedging his bet by looking at a sort of a land-based, location-based concept that might work as well. And that was that train trip that was the thing. And Ward was this very weird guy who was the only private person to own his own full-size train in his backyard in San Gabriel. It had about 900 feet of track. He would fire it up on the weekends, and they'd all drink, and they'd go back and forth on the 900 feet. And he realized at one point that he never invited the boss over to see this. And then when Walt got there and he got behind the train, that was it. That was, oh, I want that. And he tried to buy Ward's train, and he wouldn't sell it. And then he tried to buy, and this is true, a train by a guy named Casey Jones, who owned train that was from the Venice Pier, but he didn't want to sell it. He was buying it and taking it up to Gilroy, California, when it's still there. And so that's really, I think, a major reason. And Walt couldn't run his train in his backyard anymore because it burnt a small child. So I think that was a big reason why Disneyland exists, is Walt was just looking for a place for his train.
That's so cool. I was waiting for a lightning bolt to strike you when you said Mickey Mouse was boring, but it didn't happen. So that's good.
Well, but if you think about it, even Disney had thought that Mickey Mouse was struggling. That's why he did Sorcerer's Apprentice. Mm-hmm. And he was such a corporate figure. And, you know, Mickey compared to Donald, Donald was always more popular of a character, if you think about it. So
thank you.
Sam, you know, I have to say that I'm a college professor. I read a lot of people's writing, and I think most of it's really bad. And your book is so easy to read and so interesting. And I think one of the things that you realize when you read a lot of writers is when somebody has a passion. And I can just, it's just, you know, hearing you talk, it's exactly like what the book is like. I just want to sit and listen for hours and hours. But
oh, that's great.
One of the things that really interested me, and I'm only about 25% of the way through the book, but it really occurred to me that, you know, you kind of describe the thread of this interest in a theme park that really started when Walt was a little boy and moves all the way up to the premiere of Snow White. There was something there. And so can you talk about, like, even in the 1930s, end of the 1930s, he was really thinking about this whole idea. And it was sort of like, if you look back at the whole history, there were these little pieces that came together to make this happen.
Yeah, after finishing the book, it sort of seemed like it was inevitable he was going to open this place. But as a little boy, when he lived in Kansas City, he and his little sister Ruth would run over and they would peek through the fence I'm thinking it's either Luna Park or Electric Park. I forget which one in Kansas City. And that's where he saw the little popcorn lights. And that really struck him. When he ran the studio on Hyperion here in Los Angeles, Mickey Mouse was, of course, the superstar then. And there was a lot of requests to meet Mickey Mouse. You know, kids thought he was real, and Minnie Mouse. And so Walt had a little fun with that. He had little miniature cars made that said Mickey and Minnie, and they would park them just outside the gate, so it looked like, you know, that the stars of the studio were at work on a soundstage someplace. And while he was there, he was also starting to think that, you know, maybe there was some idea of a Mickey Mouse Club park. Mickey Mouse Club was a true club back in the 30s that was bigger than the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts combined. It was the largest youth group in the nation at the time. And so he was thinking of maybe a little park, a little studio. And then when he bought the property in Burbank with the funds that were generated from Snow White, he left aside a little land that was along the Los Angeles River, about 14 acres or so, for something, for a park, a little place, a place to run a train, something to do there. And even as early as 1939, he had the guys who were doing the model, the Jones brothers, that were doing the models for Pinocchio. And he asked them to go around and look at amusement parks and study them a little bit and start doing some drawings. And that was happening in 39. Then World War II came and the strike came, and that kind of pushed everything aside. So he'd been toying with the idea for a long, long, long time anyways. He loved the idea, but just could not figure out how to show the behind the curtain and show how things were made, because he felt that animation was a fairly boring thing to watch being made. You know, it's not good sausage to be made and watch. And so he struggled with, and ultimately that's why Disneyland turned out the way that it was, because he couldn't figure out that particular solution. But yeah, he was thinking about this for a long, long, long time. And then, of course, you know, he loved taking his kids to amusement parks, and his wife didn't really like amusement parks for the most part. Mm-hmm. So he was trying to figure out a way of getting to get his wife to go to one.
Wow.
Cool.
Okay, I got one for you.
All right.
You yourself, you're an urban planner as well, correct?
That's what I try to do for my day job, yes.
Right, right. You know, I was reading your book and trying to figure out urban planning. Like I'm an artist. I come from a different set of values type of thing, but it's very similar. It sounds like with urban planning, you're trying to move people both physically and emotionally.
Yes.
And so I know as Walt went into this and studied and tried to do it, two questions. Did he have an overall theme that he wanted to get across in his urban planning? And do you feel like part of the reason he keeps the park ever changing is because he feels he hasn't reached that goal? Is that why he kept saying it's going to keep changing?
Yeah, he first of all, I would disagree in the sense that say that the ethics of or the approach from both art and urban planning can actually be very, very similar. I mean, after all, architecture is frozen music, as one famous philosopher said once. So good urban planning has the same elements that good art has. It has form. It has the subject is relevant. And anyway, so his thing, I think, was mostly about respect for people and how to be able to move people through space that respected them, that allowed him to tell stories that were universal, that would require very little in the way of signage, that would strike to universal emotions, and how could he manipulate that? He knew that he could do that through the visual arts, through filmmaking. He knew he had to do that through intense manipulation because as an animator, as opposed to a traditional filmmaker, he really, really had anything that was in the background was there intentionally because it had to be drawn, whereas in a regular movie, it's usually there, but you know, sometimes you have something in the background that you didn't expect. So he knew he could take people into worlds and he can walk them through worlds and get them to suspend their disbelief and to make the impossible plausible. And then with the theme park, a lot of it was, I think it was respect of people, how to move through people through spaces, how to reduce the amount of walking that they have to do or make the walking much more enjoyable of an experience as opposed to drudgery, that sort of thing. So that's why the park itself was designed really weird. I mean, no one before Walt, no amusement park, no World's Fair ever had just a single entrance. Everybody he talked to thought that was just crazy to have just one gate, but he insisted on it because he didn't know any better. He was a movie guy, and he knew that a movie theater owner would certainly want to only have one door, so he knew how many people were in the movie theater or outside the movie theater. So he brought a different physical experience to planning that both planners just didn't think about. And that's why he's so influential today, because it worked.
And you know, Sam, I think a lot of Disney fans, you know, they hear about the story about Walt going to an amusement park with his two daughters, and he can't get on that carousel or whatever. And then they go, oh, then he built Disneyland. But I don't think a lot of people realize, and I know you touch upon this in the book, that he did a lot of research for amusement parks. He just didn't pull ideas out of the hat. He went to a lot of amusement parks at that time, and he looked at what worked, and he looked at what didn't work. Is that correct?
Yeah, he was like everything. When he became obsessed about a topic, he would study it absolutely to death. He wanted to know absolutely everything there was to know about it. So he had his guys, the Jones, and then later on other people going out and looking at every amusement park, every zoo, every museum that they possibly could. He had hired Beverly of Beverly Park. I think it's David Beverly, but I might be mistaken off the top of my head, which was an amusement park here in Southern California, to go ahead and look at all these different parks and places. Walt had, from what I understand, probably his greatest skill was that he had an amazing memory, and he could see and observe things and remember it very, very specifically. And so he would walk a street, and if the street just felt right and it was the right size and stuff, he would take measurements of that street. He would walk it and he would count and remember how wide different streets and stuff were. So he was very, very conscious. He was very conscious of that. He didn't want to. In fact, that's, I think, the reason why Disneyland succeeds is it ultimately is nothing really new. It's just a lot of things that he saw in other places that worked really, really, really well, combined in such a way that it appears to be new. It's why it feels so comfortably. And he was very smart. He did a lot of market research. That's why the theme park industry before Walt Disney were entertainers that tried to make money off of rides, whereas Walt hired people like Harrison Buzz Price and turned it into a business that was predictable and measurable, and in a sense reduced the amount of risk it would take to ensure success, financial success. So yeah, it wasn't just winging it all the time. I mean, they were trying a lot of things left and right, and if it didn't work, he was happy to pull it out really fast. But no.
That concludes part one of our discussion with Sam Genoa, author of The Disneyland Story. Join us in episode 355 of the Mickey Miles and More podcast as we continue our talk with the fascinating Sam Genoa. So for Sam Genoa and for Chris Aliopoulos and for Michelle Scribner-McLean, this is Mike Scopa saying thank you for listening, and we will see you on the road. The Mickey Miles and More podcast has been brought to you by MEI and Mouse Fan Travel, who have been planning vacations for their clients since 1998. They operate with the highest degree of integrity. They will handle your family vacation, reunion, honeymoon, corporate incentive trip, or getaway as if it were their own. They take tremendous pride on expertly representing and advocating you, their client. So give them a try. Visit mousefantravel.com or mei-travel.com and tell them that the Mickey Miles and More podcast sent you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to today's episode of the Mickey Miles and More podcast. If you would like to support the podcast, please go to mickeymiles.podbean.com and click the green Become a Patron button in the upper right-hand corner of the menu bar. We thank you for your support. Don't forget, our discussion continues on Facebook at facebook.com/MickeyMilesPodcast. You can also follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/MickeyMilesPod. Last of all, don't forget, if you have any questions for us, you can send them to questions@MickeyMilesPodcast.com, and we'll try to answer them as soon as possible. For all of us here at the Mickey Miles and More podcast, this is Rick Gregg saying thanks for listening and all your support. And until next time, we'll see you on the road.